your job is your sole source of identity and you lose it for some reason, maybe you're laid off or furloughed or it changes in some material way or you retire, if it's the sole source of identity and meaning in your life and you lose it, what's left?
Welcome to Cambridge Forum. I'm Mary Stack, and today we're beginning another mini-series concentrating on the changing nature of work. We start by examining what work means to us. Does it define us in a healthy way, or are we addicted to it? For many Americans, jobs have become akin to a religion. They provide a paycheck, but also meaning, community, and a sense of purpose. The question is, are we expecting too much of our jobs to fulfill all these needs, and at what cost? Well, to help us truly grasp some of the complex issues bound up in this equation, we've got two speakers today who are both work experts. Simo Stolzhoff used to be a design lead for IDEO, a global innovation company based in Palo Alto in California. He left, took stock, and wrote the book The Good Enough Job, Reclaiming Life from Work, in which he examines how work has come to dominate our lives and why we find it difficult to separate identity and self-worth from our jobs. Joe Hunter is the CEO of 64 Million Artists, and she co-founded this in 2014. She says she spent the first 30-odd years of her life being, quote, a massive perfectionist, anxious and terrified of failing. She finally took a month off, did a series of different creative challenges every day, and learned, quote, to enjoy the process of being creative without thinking of the outcomes. She said it changed her life. So welcome to both of you.
Lovely to be here.
Thanks for having us, Mary.
Okay, Simo, let's start with you. I found your book, which I have read, The Good Enough Job, to be an excellent study of work life. So before we talk about what you discovered, what has it done for you in doing this particular kind of research? Have you come out with any kind of, well, I wouldn't say necessarily pearls of wisdom, but methods of the way you want to live?
Yeah, you know, the old cliche is that you write the book that you need to read. And that was very much the case for me in wrestling with these issues. You know, one of the great things about writing about work for a living is that everyone has an opinion on it. I'm sure many of the people on this call have had different seasons of work taking more prominence or taking more of a backseat in their lives. So over the past 3 or so years, I embarked on a research project to investigate how work has become so central to so many people's identities and what we might be able to do about it. And I think the overarching message is about the value of diversifying our identities. So much as an investor benefits from diversifying the sources of stocks in their portfolio, we too benefit from diversifying the sources of meaning and identity in our lives. I think this is a lesson that many people have found out during the pandemic. If your job is your sole source of identity and you lose it for some reason, maybe you're laid off or furloughed or it changes in some material way or you retire, if it's the sole source of identity and meaning in your life and you lose it, what's left? I think a lot of people also learn the risk of just the sky-high expectations that we place on our jobs. I'm kind of smack dab in the middle of the millennial generation. I think many of my peers joined the workforce with very high aspirations for what work could do for them, a source of not just a paycheck, but also perhaps self-actualization and community and purpose and meaning. And if you think about happiness is the difference between our expectations and our reality, it can leave a lot of room for disappointment. And the third risk, I think, has become particularly clear during the pandemic, which is if work is so central, if it becomes the sole source of identity and meaning in your life, it can neglect other parts of who we are. The psychoanalyst Esther Perel has this great quote where she says, "Too many people bring the best of themselves to work and then bring the leftovers home." And as you know, Jo found out in her experiments, we are all so much more than just workers. We are neighbors and artists and friends and parents and citizens. And if we are just investing in one aspect of who we are, those other identities, those other sources of potential meaning in our lives can wither.
One of the points that you made in the book was, I think people that valued their work, the importance of it over their spouse, that really surprised me.
Yeah, and it's particularly true for people who are college educated, people who tend to have white collar knowledge worker jobs. They tend to mention their work as a source of meaning over twice the rate of mentioning their spouse. And this holds true across cultures, you know, particularly in the United States, work has become akin to a religion, as you mentioned, but this is true in South Korea and Sweden, especially for what I'd say highly educated, high earners. Work has become the most important source of meaning in people's lives. And we can talk about how that sort of cuts both ways.
The journalist Derek Thompson, who writes for The Atlantic, has done quite a lot of work on addressing the world of work in the 21st century. And I think he coined that term workism, which is rooted in the belief that many Americans share that work can provide everything we historically expected from organized religion, as you've just said. Can you comment on this idea, but also you do a kind of potted history of work?
Yeah. So, you know, if you think about how work has become so central to Americans' lives, there's lots of different ways to slice it. You can take a historical approach, economic approach. You know, if you think back to the foundation of our country, the Protestant work ethic and capitalism were really the two strands that entwined to form our country's DNA. You know, part of the reason why our relationship to work is so fraught is because the consequences of losing work are so dire. You can talk about the tax structure in this country and the ways in which people's increased hours at work can lead to more consolidation of wealth. But the reason that I really harp on is this subjective value that Americans give to work, this kind of cultural importance of work in a country that treats CEOs like celebrities and plasters always do what you love on the walls of our co-working spaces. And this has been particularly true in the last 40 or 50 years. We see a precipitous decline in organized religion, in neighborhood and community groups, these institutions that once provided meaning and belonging and community in people's lives have deteriorated. And yet those human needs remain. And many people have turned to the place where they spend the majority of their time, which is the office.
So you say when money and inner fulfillment, it's funny because back in the 50s and the 60s, you would never have heard a worker talking about any of this stuff. Inner fulfillment. I mean, they did their job, they had their spare time, they had their hobbies. You know, that was a very important part of people's lives. You didn't expect necessarily your work or your job to fulfill anything except paying your paycheck and making sure you had, you know, all your overheads covered. But that's also going back to the history of unions, which you also allude to in the book. So you say that in money and inner fulfillment, when it coalesces, it's a kind of unhealthy union, which I tend to agree. And you suggest cultivating, quote, greater self-complexity and distinct sources of meaning, which will make you better equipped to weather the inevitable challenges of life. I guess, in other words, if you lose your job, you won't lose anything, everything. How do you cultivate greater self-complexity?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think to be clear, I don't think there's anything wrong with trying to align your work with your interests or the impact that you hope to have in the world. Certainly, we work more than we do just about anything else, and how we spend those hours matter. But you know, the argument that I make in the book and the research backs this up is about the value of also investing in aspects of your life beyond work. Self-complexity is just a fancy way of saying investing in different sides of yourself to become a more well-rounded human. And the research shows that people who have greater self-complexity tend to be more resilient in the face of adversity. This, of course, makes sense. If you are rising and falling based on your professional accomplishments, and your boss says something disparaging, or you have a bad day at the office, it can very easily spill over into all of the other aspects of your life. But research also shows that people who tend to cultivate interests and hobbies outside of the workplace tend to be better workers. They tend to be more innovative, more creative, especially in an age of AI where the source of our inspiration becomes that much more important. People who frankly have lives tend to be able to solve the complex challenges of our day. So that's sort of the business case, but I also think it's very important to make the moral case. I think, you know, we shouldn't just work less because it makes us better workers. I think we should work less because it makes us better humans. It allows us to have the energy to invest in our relationships, to invest in our local communities, to invest in parts of ourselves, which I'm sure Joe will talk more about later, that aren't easily monetizable. These reminders that we exist on this earth to do more than just produce economic value. And so I interviewed many psychologists for the book, and they talk about treating these sort of type A, overachieving, ambitious professionals. And they say, okay, you should, you know, develop more self-complexity. You should try and invest in elements of yourself other than work. And they say, I've got it. I'm going to sign up for an Ironman, or I'm going to read 52 books this year. And in that way, they sort of quantify and measure their leisure and turn it into another form of work. And so one antidote in my mind is to invest in activities or sources of meaning that aren't anchored on any sort of achievement or necessarily betterment, especially not monetizable things. I think play can be a great antidote to our work-centric society, and could take many forms. If you like to dance, it can be dancing. If you play an instrument, it can be jamming. It can be sitting on the porch and having a long conversation. It can be crafting. These activities that you do for the inherent joy of being able to do them rather than any supposed output or way of contributing to the world economically.
It's interesting you say that, because I came across the expression spare time in the BBC article. And I haven't heard that expression for years. It's part of the lexicon of certainly a British person would say spare time. And what the tendency here is people to make that into another job. So it's not enough you go for a walk, you've got to count 10,000 steps, which is why I won't do any of that stuff. I mean, I don't want to be aware. I want to not think. I want to just enjoy walking. And this idea that almost every activity has to be anchored to come some kind of performance or outcome, it's just very unhealthy. That's just something I noted today in reading. That expression was so lovely, spare time. If you say that to a lot of people, they'd say, oh, I don't have any spare time.
I mean, I think people can start small. You know, I think investing in elements outside of work doesn't have to be these grand sweeping gestures, or say, okay, I'm going to become a baker, or I'm going to become a marathon runner. I think it's about carving out space where, for one, multitasking isn't an option. You can't have one eye on your email when hopefully you're going on a walk with your best friend or you're in a yoga class. They provide natural barriers to being able to be in that state of like a shark sleeping with one eye open, always in a state of perpetual half work. And then the second is, it doesn't have to be a grand sweeping gesture. It can just be one way to invest in your non-work self. So as an example, you know, I'm Jewish, and right now we are in the high holy days, the sort of Jewish holidays, and Judaism is an identity that lives inside me. Most of the year, it's pretty dormant. I'm more on the ish side of Jewish these days. But by participating in the rituals and the practices and the community, it is an identity that swells, that grows in importance, and therefore grows in meaning. So in that way, our identities are sort of like plants. They need both time and energy in order to grow. And I think part of the problem of a culture and a society that is so centered around work is that too often people, whether by choice or by force, are giving all of their best time and energy just to one aspect of who they are.
You're listening to Cambridge Forum's Reclaiming Life from Work with journalist Simo Stolzoff, author of the book, The Good Enough Job, and Joe Hunter, CEO and co-founder of 64 Million Artists, discussing the nature of our relationship with work and how it shapes our identity. Well, Joe's got a lot to report on this. I think one thing that's kind of interesting as we segue to you is in the book you say that in 1975, Americans and Germans worked the same number of hours on average. By 2021, Americans worked 30% more. So what happened here, I'm wondering? Partly it must have been the decline of kind of labor unions, which allowed some of this to happen. Part of it is, I imagine, technology, which enables it. And then there were the social changes that you alluded to, the end of the bowling leagues and the church groups and the clubs. So going over now in sight of that, because both of you are in Europe as we speak, Joe, you yourself were a kind of bit of an alcoholic. a workaholic not too long ago. So what kind of precipitated your shift away from what you were doing and how you were doing it?
Well, I think it's so interesting, it's so great to hear someone talk about his work, because I think, you know, I've been someone that's for most of my work life I've been in kind of arts and culture, and I think there's an expectation in arts and culture that you should love your job and that your job should be your life and that you're lucky and that you're kind of privileged to be in this position. And that's kind of, you know, how I sometimes felt and was sometimes made to feel as I kind of came up through my career, and then sort of found myself 10 years ago, you know, in what I had always assumed would be my dream job, and actually realizing, you know, I think, I don't know if this is the same in the States, but in the UK, the arts is kind of one of the least creative professions. If you're not an artist, if you're, you know, anything other than on the stage or making the paintings or doing anything, actually it's a really kind of ancient system. And, you know, there's very little opportunity for kind of innovation or doing things differently. It's, and I suddenly felt kind of incredibly stuck. I was also having a big breakup, doing all sorts of different things in my personal life, and suddenly was like, this, I've got this wrong. I feel, you know, I was having panic attacks. I felt really anxious. And so I took a month off work and I asked people to set me different creative challenges to do each day, really with just a sense of just like, I need to be doing something different. And I've sort of got to a point where I'm just completely stuck and I don't know how to get out of this. And because I had been so obsessed with, it has to be right. It has to be good. It has to be, I have to be good. I have to be right. It was just so refreshing, and it kind of opened my eyes up to a completely different way of being, because I was just failing every day or like trying something new that I didn't think I would only ever try things that I thought I'd be really good at. You know, why would I try something I thought we were bad at? Meeting new people, you know, the arts, as a result of expecting you to be there all the time and have this, you know, have this devotion, is pretty elitist, very white, very middle class, very particular kind of education, you know. And here I was out in the world doing all these sorts of different things, doing, meeting lots of different people. And I was like, oh, I've seemed to have completely missed the point of what creativity is about. This is what it's about. And so I quit my job 2 weeks into that and started 64 Million Artists, which was 53 million originally, population of England. Then it was 64, the population of the UK. And now it's not even the population of the UK anymore, but we can't keep changing the name.
I imagine you shocked a lot of people that you worked for when you left that job.
Yeah, I think it, you know, it was a great job in lots of people's eyes. I'm sure my parents were a bit terrified. And I think, you know, I was, you know, it was a massive privilege for me that I felt like I was kind of, because I kind of learned the system and I knew I was at a particular level and I knew there were certain skills I had that I could kind of sell as a freelancer. You know, I could raise money, and everyone in the arts needs someone that can raise money. It was a big risk, but for me, it was a sort of calculated risk. But I think what really shocked people over time was the kind of change in me. I think, you know, people might have seen me as a particular way and a particular kind of achiever. And I think it's changed who I am, how I interact with people, how I maintain my friendships, how I invest in my relationships, how, you know, now who I am as a parent. You know, it's it's fundamental because it's, you know, I am not just who I am at work. You know, my work is not just who I am. It comes from being a whole person and kind of, and experimenting with that person. Like someone was just saying, it's that kind of, you know, who we need to develop all the different aspects of our lives. You know, I was able to do up my flat by watching YouTube videos because I had the confidence to to do it in a way that I would never have done before, because I was, the thing that I was good at was work, and so that's what I invested in.
It's interesting that we, if you rewind this right back to the origin of what you're saying, it's talking about having the courage to fail at something, which almost is antithetical now to the way that society is developing, certainly for children. The more and more I read, Harvard's just brought out another book of this dilemma of parenting, where you've got to have perfect children. And from the get-go, they've got to be primed to achieve and make that place in that school. So the possibilities of them even sort of fiddling around with something becomes sort of a luxury. And yet some of the greatest inventors in all fields have come about because of people either making a mistake or stumbling into something and having the time to observe it. And I'm just wondering if we're doing the whole thing wrong, driven by the profit margin.
I mean, it's very resonant for me at the moment, because my son has just started school, so he's in his second week of school. And it's kind of this, it's such an interesting thing to kind of go through and to watch him do it and to kind of experience this, even within that first couple of weeks, that kind of immediate kind of molding and shaping and uniforming, and you know, that just happens so instinctively in a school. And for me to be like, oh, I obviously want him to be able to like exist in society, and yet I don't want him. I'm sort of realizing what that school system, you know, he's a four, and there was this little moment where he was struggling to go in and he wasn't quite ready, and the teacher said to him, come on, you're four now, you can come in, you know, as if you're four now, wow, you're so old, 4 years old, you should really learn to be able to fit into the system and sort yourself out and be able to come through the door. And it's, for me, it's a really sort of triggering thing, where I'm like, oh yeah, that was me, this kind of massive, I remember being 2, 3, 4 and being full of emotion and full of everything, you know, so creative, it's pouring out of me, and suddenly having to be into this kind of system that was sort of funneling me through. And because I am also a nice, good girl who should be good, I went along with it. And that is what made me put everything to my job, because I was also clever. So if you're clever, what you should do is do this kind of job. You should, you know, you should follow this kind of path. You should go to this university. And that, you know, shrunk me until suddenly, I think essentially what happened is, you know, all that stuff that had been squeezed in, I was just sort of popping out all over the place, giving me those panic attacks. And I think
interesting.
I'm
sure there's some origin of truth, and it makes perfect sense. If you stifle something for a long time, eventually it pops out. And panic attacks are often the first indicator of that. You also went through a little bit of that, didn't you, Simo? Because you had very successful parents, and you said at one point you were kind of oscillating because, you know, you had the chance to go to graduate school, and you also were in this good job, and it was almost, as you say, you know, one of the luxuries of having great education and options. You're almost scared to put a foot wrong.
You know, I think it can cut both ways. On one hand, it's an incredible privilege to be able to have options, to be able to have choice about what you want to do. Certainly, the majority of people in the world do not work to self-actualize. They work to survive. And yet, in the culture, if we are telling everyone that your job is who you are, your job is the only way that you can make a difference in the world, that's an incredible amount of pressure, especially to put on young people. And as we're seeing the sort of professionalization of school, this burden is getting placed on younger and younger and younger humans. And when you are framing a job as being not only your paycheck, but your way of self-expressing in the world, your way of presenting yourself at a dinner party when you meet someone new. It can feel like the stakes are incredibly high, that you must make the right decision as opposed to make the decision right.
Interesting. So we've missed a very important point about you, Joe, which is that you wrote this very good piece, opinion piece for The Guardian, where you talked about why you had a 4-day work week for your company and why everybody took the entire month of August off. So your entire workforce have just come back from having a month off. And you said that you felt that in a climate where people are suffering from increased mental illness, absenteeism, and all sorts of other maladies, sick days, that this really wasn't a big deal, that it made really solid sense and it's worked for your company. So tell me a bit about that. Was an experiment you did, was it last year for the first time?
Yeah, so we did it last year. You know, we were certainly noticing that, you know, everyone we were working with, whether that was people in offices, people in schools, people in social care and health, everyone felt really burnt out and we were having to hold space for them. And everyone, we all felt like, you know, we'd just come through the pandemic and sort of wobbling out the other side, and everyone was exhausted. And it was actually, we read an article by Brené Brown, who said that she was actually herself taking 3 months off, but giving all of her staff an extra 4 weeks off over the summer, and essentially kind of shutting down what they were doing as a kind of recognition of, you know, we've all just been through this massive global event and no one seems to have done anything differently or noticed. Or, you know, things changed massively and now we're all trying to just get back to normal. As soon as I read that, it was like, that's a really good idea. Let's do that. And that was in May. It was sort of a rush to get it done. But when people came back after, it's so clear that they'd had this really important time to decompress, to be themselves, to not have to wear a work hat, to kind of, and people did very different things. I was actually having a really tough time. There's loads of stuff going on at home that was really stressful. And it's not like I laid by a pool and relaxed, but what I didn't have to do was be another person. I just could be mum and me, like wife. That were the main things that I had to do in that time. And it was so essential for me to not completely burn out. And so when we came back and we were ready to like start work, it felt like we were renewed. We had a really exciting sense of what we wanted to do. We'd also just had chance to, so all the things that felt like they were important by the summer, at the beginning of the summer, when the time we got back, it was like, actually that thing is not worth doing. We can cut that. We can do this. We could be much bolder about how we thought about things. And we increased turnover by 50%. We've increased our staff by 50%. We've just taken August off again and we've put it in as a kind of standard work practice for the next however long. And we're pretty much, look, I think we'll do the same again. I think we'll be pretty much double the size again by this time next year. And it was like you were saying, Sima, the reason to do it isn't because of productivity. We're doing it because we genuinely believe it's really important for people. It's really important for us to take a break, to be ourselves, to have that time. And it does also make really good business sense for us because it really works.
On that note, I'm going to say thanks to Sima Stolzoff, Joe Hunter, and thanks to everyone who joined us online. Cambridge Forum is made possible through the generosity of Herbert and Dorothy Vetter, the Lowell Institute, Mass Cultural Council, Cambridge Community Foundation, and of course, all of you. So if you want to donate or sign up to our list, please visit the website, cambridgeforum.org. Thank you all for joining us, and I hope to see you all soon.